I'm James Lawler, and you are listening to Climate Now. This episode is part of our Decarbonizing Transportation series, co-hosted by Darren Howe, Senior Charging Manager at Cruise and former Applications Engineer at Tesla.
In another episode, we explored different methods of decarbonizing the trucking industry and learned that many segments of this industry could be electrified. Today, James and I are talking about how to decarbonize the harder-to-electrify long-haul, heavy-duty Class 8 trucks. The big tractor-trailer semi-trucks, classified as Class 8 vehicles, account for well over 1 billion tons of CO2 emissions each year. These heavy-duty trucks are a lot harder to decarbonize because batteries are less energy-dense than diesel, so you need a lot of batteries to power a huge truck that is traveling long distances. And those batteries take up weight and space on a freight truck, which takes away from that available for the product that this truck is transporting.
We had the opportunity to speak with two entrepreneurs who are working to decarbonize long-haul Class 8 trucks with two different technologies. Bav Roy is the co-founder and chief operating officer of Verne, which is spelled V-E-R-N-E. Verne is a startup optimizing hydrogen storage for fuel cell trucks. Paul Gross is the co-founder and co-CEO of Remora, a startup that captures carbon from the exhaust pipe of trucks. Today, we are going to hear about how these two technologies can contribute to decarbonizing trucking and where Verne and Remora are, respectively, in terms of bringing them to market. Let's start by getting a better sense of what each of these companies is aiming to do. First, hearing from Bav Roy of Verne.
So at the highest level, Verne produces high-density hydrogen storage systems for use on board fuel cell vehicles. So today, fuel cell vehicles, you might see them on the road. There's fuel cell cars, fuel cell buses, fuel cell trucks. They store hydrogen in a compressed gas form, either at 350 bar or 700 bar in storage tanks made of carbon fiber, as well as either metallic or polymer liner.
And for our listeners, 350 or 700 bar are these very high pressures at which you are storing the hydrogen to optimize the fuel density, so that the space the fuel is taking up, say on your Class 8 truck, is minimized. So what is different about the hydrogen storage systems that Verne is making?
Yeah, so Verne is able to store hydrogen at double the density without having to go to a higher pressure. If you look at the thermodynamic graph of hydrogen, what we do is we operate in a space that's called cryocompression. So today, hydrogen stored at that compressed gas at ambient temperature. Hydrogen can also be stored as a very cold liquid, think minus 253 degrees Celsius. What Verne's doing is storing it at a low temperature and moderate pressure. So not quite as cold as liquid, but still cold. And so what this means is that we can get the highest possible densities allowed by thermodynamics, and we have the operational flexibility that comes with compressed gas.
What does that get you if you're able to store the hydrogen at double the density?
And so that means is you have half the weight, half the cost, half the volume. And for reasons that are a bit complicated, we have even further safety features than their systems would. And so that means it's a great outcome for existing hydrogen trucks on their current routes. But it also means you can store double the amount of hydrogen going on much longer routes that today, hydrogen trucks can't yet serve.
Hmm. Yeah. And tell us a little bit more. What is the figure of merit that you kind of fixate around, or multiple ones? For example, people talk a lot about cost per kilogram. Is that what you're looking at? Is there a storage equivalent of that cost?
So there is a dollar per kilogram hydrogen stored. So today, where the cost is you know, roughly $500 per kilogram of hydrogen stored. That's the production cost for companies. They're selling them at much higher, say $1,000 per kilogram. Then what the DOE target is for 2030 is $300 per kilogram in hydrogen cost. And so we can see a path to getting to actually below $300, or we're targeting to $70 per kilogram just by scaling our existing technology. We also have an extensive R&D program that will is aiming to get even further below that.
Yeah, well, help level set me here a bit, because I'm probably thinking of a different metric. When you say $300, $500 per kilogram, I'm used to seeing people saying that, you know, the long-term goal of hydrogen to your vehicle is something like $8 per kilogram. Are we talking about different metrics here?
What I'm talking about is the cost of the storage system itself. Mm. There's also another very important cost, which is the cost of the hydrogen.
The cost of hydrogen delivered.
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
Got it.
And so where we see hydrogen going is, for example, a recent Morgan Stanley report says that hydrogen fuel will get to $2 per kilogram by 2030. And this is production cost. DOE is targeting $1 per kilogram. They're investing a lot to hit, you know, more aggressive cost levels. At those sort of levels, hydrogen becomes cost competitive with diesel fuel. Mm-hmm. So one is sort of the fuel cost for the vehicle, which is the $2 per kilogram of H2 fuel. And the storage cost is sort of upfront capex that would be amortized over the many thousands or hundreds of thousands of kilograms that would be used over the lifetime.
While Verne's technology is aiming to make hydrogen viable for Class 8 trucking by cutting the cost, weight, and space required for fuel storage on board in half, Paul Gross's company Remora is taking an entirely different approach to decarbonizing trucking.
I'm Paul. I'm the co-founder and CEO at Remora. Remora is a 27-person company in Detroit. We build a device that captures the carbon emissions from a semi-truck.
Instead of using a hydrogen fuel cell or electric battery pack, Remora is adding a carbon capture device to existing diesel trucks.
So our device is like a big box that goes on the back of the truck, right between the truck and the trailer. It attaches to the truck's tailpipes, and then it captures at least 80% of the truck's carbon emissions. And the driver offloads the carbon dioxide while they refuel. And then we take that carbon dioxide and sell it to concrete producers or other end users. And we're able to share that revenue from the carbon dioxide back with the owner of the truck. So we can help big fleets dramatically reduce their carbon emissions, meet their climate commitments, and then earn this new stream of revenue from the carbon dioxide at the same time.
So how does the expense of this approach compare with just making a clean energy vehicle like hydrogen or electric? What's the added upfront cost of putting one of your capture devices on a new truck? And does the revenue you make actually make a dent in that procurement cost?
So, I mean, when we're talking about a new electric truck right now, we're talking about a $400,000 truck. And we're talking about 150 or 200 miles of range, hours of charging time, and then obviously charging on a grid that's still mainly powered by fossil fuels. So it's not carbon neutral. Our device is $30,000. So, you know, it's and a new truck is $150,000. So we're a pretty small chunk of that cost of the new truck. But even more exciting is that we can generate about $22,000 per year from selling the carbon dioxide that we capture. And we share that revenue back with the owner of the truck. We share half of it. So they're earning about $11,000 a year. So they break even on the device in you know, just under 3 years. So it's not even adding cost for them. It's actually going to make them some money in addition to reducing their emissions. And any other solution is going to be dramatically more expensive.
And you've also advertised this as kind of a now solution, right? Because it will take a long time to retire the existing fleet of fossil fuel burning trucks and replace them with a purely zero emission option.
So you're exactly right. Generally, we see trucks on the road for at least 1 million miles of driving. That is actually, you know, conservative. We'd be expecting maybe 10 to 15 years in service. And even then, sometimes really old trucks are continue to run in a third or fourth owner's hands. So it's really crucial to find something that can decarbonize these existing trucks, because even if we started only building electric trucks right now, we'd have to wait 15 or 20 years for the fleet turnover. And we are not anywhere near that. So, you know, I think we'd be looking at decades and decades until we had a full fleet turnover. And that's just not an amount of time we have when it comes to the climate crisis. It's upon us right now. So we need a solution that's ready to go right now.
Both Verne and Remora are just getting started. And we were curious to learn more about how these companies aim to disrupt a very established industry.
First, we had questions for Bab about what kind of infrastructure their hydrogen storage systems would need and how to get that online at the same time they're deploying their technology into trucks.
A 2021 report from the National Renewable Energy Lab found that by 2025, fuel cell trucks and battery electric trucks could be cost competitive with diesel heavy-duty trucks. So the premise of Verne's business model that truck fleet operators will invest in hydrogen fuel cell trucks as they replace their fleet you know, seems reasonable. But we're wondering, you know, if these various options are comparably priced, why choose the fuel cell model?
When we think about how truck owner operators make their purchasing decisions, they think about the fuel costs, they think about the upfront capex, but they also think about their operations. Where can I fuel it? How long will it take? And how much does this technology impact how much I can carry on my truck in terms of weight and volume?
And what are the infrastructural considerations around fueling a heavy-duty truck using hydrogen versus charging an electric truck, would you say?
Yeah, so that's actually one of the other advantages for hydrogen. So for batteries, they're going to have a charger. Ideally, they'll have a fast charger that will allow for reasonable fueling times. Versus hydrogen, what we're talking about is something not that dissimilar to filling at a diesel pump today. You're talking about a hydrogen station filling up with that cryocompressed gas or compressed gas using existing tech. Firstly, you need to develop fast chargers for battery electric trucks in order to make sure you're serving the sort of operational needs of these trucks. And that doesn't yet exist in an accessible way for many of these truck owners. Second, in terms of infrastructure utilization, given it takes so long to charge a truck using battery electric technology, each charger today can serve, you know, a handful of trucks. In contrast, a hydrogen station, you can use that same station to fuel anywhere from 10 to 1,000 of these fuel cell trucks. And so you get much better economies of scale for that fueling infrastructure. And then another point, if we talk beyond just the fueling infrastructure, but also the electrical infrastructure behind that, the demands on the grid for charging, for fast charging a battery electric truck, a heavy duty truck, is going to be substantial. So we're talking, say, roughly a megawatt of power demand to fast charge a truck. And that's just one truck. If you start talking about many of these trucks, that's actually a very significant draw on the local grid. For fuel cells, at the point of the station, you won't need nearly as much upgrade of the local grid. You will need centralized production of that hydrogen, which will use a lot of electricity, but it's in a way that's much more compatible with the way our grid's designed today than having to draw a lot of power from far along the distribution network.
Interesting. So this technology cools the hydrogen to allow for more dense storage. The cooling mechanism must take up some power, right, in order to perform that. So how does that work?
The onboard storage, just to be clear, does not have active cooling. It's just, it's filled in that cold state and it's kept cold through insulation. But yes, it does take energy to get it cold in that first place. So now today, if we look at the way hydrogen is produced, then distributed around California, it's produced centrally through a way that's not yet green. It's steam methane reforming, but it's then liquefied to create the high densities, and it's transported in liquid tankers to fuel stations. And so it's actually arriving in a very cold state already. And so in order to fill Verne tanks, what you do is you go through existing, like slight modifications to existing infrastructure, which is a cryopump, which converts that liquid to supercritical gas. And so actually what we're doing is just keeping that hydrogen cold. We're not cooling it.
From the perspective of building this cryogenic storage or the dispensers, what are the scientific or engineering challenges that you guys still need to solve?
I guess let me start with what's already proven. What's already proven is the high densities that's been sort of proven through demonstrations at a national lab that we're working with, as well as I work at one of the auto OEMs. That's proven. What hasn't been proven is the 11,000 life cycle. So the very long-term durability of the system. And that's where Verne has IP and where we're working to actually demonstrate that higher durability. Technically, there's also more work to be done to get easily accessible dispensing equipment. So to go from that cryocompressed state to actually filling one of these tanks. We're talking about like a hose, the nozzle, a very sort of engineering level. We see that as being engineering risk, not so much science risk. And we're working with various vendors to get the right equipment there in place. But we don't see this as being a showstopper, just something that requires engineering work to essentially insulate what already exists.
We had questions for Remora too.
both about how their technology works and the infrastructure they would need to offload the CO2 from their containers.
Can you tell us about the carbon capture technology that you use in your device, in Remora's devices? So, you know, just for our listeners, you've sent us this picture, and what we're looking at together now is sort of these two large canisters, cylindrical canisters, and they're set up on, you know, the back of the truck in this case. And it appears that exhaust from the truck would pass through these canisters. The canisters, it looks like, are filled with small porous beads. So the CO2 presumably enters the pores and is somehow captured there. And then you use heat from the truck's exhaust to release the CO2 from the pores. So I'm wondering, can you tell us a bit more about what is going on chemically when you're trapping and releasing the CO2 in this fashion?
Yeah, what's amazing is this is actually a physical adsorption process. Okay. The carbon dioxide molecules literally get stuck in the pores. There isn't a chemical reaction going on. And that is one of the reasons that this is a more energy efficient way to do carbon capture, because when we are releasing the carbon dioxide and regenerating the adsorbent, we don't have to break chemical bonds. We just have to open the pores, and then the carbon dioxide molecules come out. So it's kind of amazingly simple.
And this was the original concept that your co-founder, Christina Reynolds, designed?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was one of the big things she figured out during her PhD, is that this type of adsorption process is going to be the most efficient and energy efficient for us to use on the truck. And in theory, we could power this entire system just with heat from the truck's exhaust. We're still getting better and better at pulling that energy from the truck's exhaust. And that's one of our other big engineering goals.
And so, Paul, to go back to your business model, you mentioned the owner of a truck could benefit to the tune of about $11,000 a year, considering the 50-50 split with Remora for the revenue from the CO2 that you would be selling. So how does that work in terms of infrastructure that you need around this product?
When the truck gets back to its distribution center at the end of the day, the driver offloads the carbon dioxide. So we install, for our initial pilot partners, we install an offload tank at every distribution center. And the offloading process is incredibly simple. The driver attaches a hose to the device. The device pumps the carbon dioxide out into the offload tank, and then the driver detaches the hose and they're done. So it just takes 5 minutes. They don't have to fiddle around with the device or do anything fancy. It's just like refueling in reverse. And we've made it as simple as possible. After that, once the offload tank fills up, we come by with a tanker truck and bring the CO2 to the end user who pays us for it. And that's it. The offload tank is really big. It takes up about the space of a trailer. This is a 30-ton capacity, so we can do about 50 loads before we need to then come and pick it up.
What do those logistics actually look like? Do you own and operate that infrastructure? Are you leasing that? Are you providing a service? Like, how does that work?
It's a great question. We will own the tankers that move the CO2. We'll work with our customers to transport those tankers. You know, our customers are trucking companies. They can haul the CO2 tankers with their trucks outfitted with our device. So we're not adding more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere by transporting the CO2. And we'll own and install the offload tanks as well. So we'll own a lot of the infrastructure. We want to make sure that we're doing this as efficiently and low carbon as possible. And we'll provide it as a service to our customers. So we will be picking up that CO2, and that's how we'll be taking our half of the revenue from the CO2 to pay for that service.
So is it sort of like equipment sales? You know, you are getting sales from selling your retrofit device into the trucks, and then you're also doing kind of a service facility by saying, hey, like, let's remove your carbon for you over time.
That's exactly right. And the service comes as a package deal with the equipment. We provide the service for all of the devices that we get on the road.
Makes sense.
And how many miles can a truck go before their tanks are full of CO2 and they need to offload?
For our first generation device, the range is 500 miles. For our second generation device, the range will look like about 900 miles. We can always add more range. We can just add more CO2 tanks. So there's no technical limit there. It's just a question of how much range these trucks need. And all of our initial pilot partners are running round trips that are less than 500 miles. So we don't really need a longer range device. But in the future, we're going to be installing offload tanks at truck stops and in addition to distribution centers. And we'd really like to support over the road routes, the really long haul routes, you know, from coast to coast. And that will require longer range models of our device.
Yeah. Just to give us a sense of the economics, you know, when we take a look at that offload tank there, how much is the value of CO2 that is contained within that when it's full? I'm just kind of curious, like give our audience a sense of like the economics here.
Totally. When that tank fills up, and it fills up very often, you know, when we're even at 10 trucks, we'll be doing several pickups a week. So at every tank load is about $4,500. That's at the very, very low end of pricing for CO2. It could be two or three times that amount. And, you know, we're going to have constant truckloads of CO2 basically coming out of these offload tanks.
So $4,500 per 30-ton tank of CO2 translates to $150 per ton of CO2. And for our listeners, that's at the lower end in terms of pricing for high purity carbon dioxide that can be used in markets like cement or in the food industry. Lower purity CO2 can sell for a lot less than that.
And I'm just trying to get a sense of the tactical considerations your fleet partners are going through when they're thinking about this. What are the things that they ask you when they're like, hey, you know, how do I put it on my trucks? How do I put this infrastructure in the ground? How much will it cost me? Can you walk us through what you hear?
Definitely. The main questions are about how this technology affects the truck. So we talk about how this fully retrofits onto the truck. We use the existing bolt holes in the truck for aftermarket retrofits. We don't make any permanent changes to the truck. We don't affect the truck's aerodynamics. In fact, we may slightly improve the truck's aerodynamics. And we, most importantly, don't affect the health of the truck's engine. So in our extensive dynamometer testing, we found that even at the highest loads, we're putting very negligible back pressure on the truck's engine, something like 0.27 PSI. We're decreasing horsepower by far less than 1%. So that is really important to our trucking partners.
The last thing we wanted from our guests was to get a sense of how fast these technologies could get to market and what still needed to be accomplished before either company made a dent in decarbonizing long-haul heavy-duty trucking.
I wonder if there's a way to sort of summarize, you know, what would it take, right, to get from where we are now to a hydrogen-powered truck that could go 1,000 miles or to serve a 1,000-mile route?
Yeah.
Could you fit a truck with Verne's tanks and stand up a filling station at the 500-mile mark or something?
Yeah. So with the storage system that we're currently building, our first, what we're calling a backup cab system that will go between the truck cabin and the trailer, we were storing about anywhere between 110 and 120 kilograms of hydrogen, which is enough to go that range.
500 to 1,000 miles?
Yeah. So we're targeting roughly 800 miles with that range, potentially even further. And this is sort of our first generation product. There's definitely going to need to be improvements on that to ensure it can go the 11,000 cycles that we're targeting and whatnot. It will take time to actually get a mass manufacturable product, but the sort of fundamentals are there that it can, without significant cost or volume, get to that range. And so that's what really gets us excited, is that we can, like, by getting to such high ranges, we can really reduce the infrastructure requirement. You need far fewer fueling stations if you can have those much longer ranges.
And is the technology in place today where we could build a filling station that could fill up a Verne tank?
Yeah, so we could actually do that today with relatively minor modifications to the fueling infrastructure. So most of the modern fueling stations use what I mentioned before was a cryo pump, which converts that liquid to compressed gas. But what it does is it converts it to that cold pressurized state, but then the hydrogen runs through a vaporizer to heat that hydrogen up to a temperature that is compatible with the existing storage tanks on the road today. So the main modification that we'd need is to actually just not have that vaporizer and just let it stay in that cold state. And so that's sort of one of the main modifications. The others you need to ensure the hose and the dispenser can actually keep it at that cold temperature, but beyond that, we could do it. And so we see probably 12 months out, we could get our first fueling station ready. But this is more on the technology side. There's other things that are required to get any sort of station up and running.
And do you see that as a industry challenge, commonizing the standards of how hydrogen will be dispensed? For example, if you are just doing this in your own dedicated fleet depot, then of course you can buy the right trucks and have the right dispensers. But do you see, like, for example, in the future, truck stops of the future dispensing hydrogen, will they need to communicate with every truck and say, hey, you want this pressure, you want this temperature? Is that something that exists today?
So today, the way it works is that each dispenser will either dispense at 350 bar or 700 bar, so different pressures. As we start to have these higher density solutions available, whether that's liquid hydrogen storage or cryocompressed storage, we see them being a sort of different lines on a similar station, on the same station. So you will need to make sure you're filling up with the right fuel. So in the same way that you don't fill it with diesel, you don't fill your gas vehicle with diesel today, or even your EV with gas today, there will need to be some of that signage. Where Verne's technology has, it's just like another advantage, is that because we are compatible with pressure and cold temperatures, our tanks could be filled with just standard compressed gas if for some reason cryocompressed gas was not available. It wouldn't be nearly as ideal, but you can still run the vehicle without impediments. Verne definitely has a role to play in ensuring the right infrastructure is there, and we'll definitely partner with fuel station developers to ensure the right equipment is there. And then as we've got a touch point with the fuel station, as well as the truck operator, there's definitely a role for Verne to play in connecting the two and sort of matching that supply and demand to ensure that fleets can get the right type of hydrogen at the right time for lowest cost.
Paul, can you talk a little bit about where you are in the process of producing these systems? As in, you know, if I'm a trucking fleet owner, could I buy a bunch of systems from you today, or could I put in an order?
So we are starting our initial pilots in January. We've now signed up 16 multi-billion dollar fleets for pilots, including 9 of the Fortune 500, a couple of the Fortune 10, and then some of the largest trucking companies in the country. So we're working with Cargill, we're working with Ryder, some really big companies. And those companies have reserved all of our pilot slots through 2022. That's going to be us testing our first generation unit, making sure that it's working for drivers, it's working operationally. And then we'll be scaling up to commercialization in 2023. And that's when we'll be building, you know, thousands and then tens of thousands of these units. And that's the moment when folks will be able to place orders and we'll be able to roll this out really quickly. So if they're, you know, if fleet owners are interested in getting involved, they can absolutely, again, sign up for updates or just reach out to us and we can put them on a list to get some of those first units in 2023.
And Paul, do you have a sense in terms of total, you know, road transport emissions, and then looking at the percentage of that total that's emitted by Class 8 trucks, which is the kind of truck that your device would apply to, what's the carbon capture potential of sort of wide-scale deployment of this technology?
So transportation is the largest sector of emissions in the US, and then semi-trucks emit 339 million metric tons of carbon dioxide every year. And to put that in context, that's 5% of the entire US carbon footprint. If we got this device on every semi truck in the US, we could just really take a big chunk out of the US's climate impact. And that's just semi trucks. This device, this technology, would work incredibly well for other forms of vehicles like rail, for cargo ships, it would work for mining haul trucks. And we plan to expand to those sectors as well. So we could, you know, around the world have several gigatons of impact when we get this technology fully deployed.
That was Paul Gross, who is co-founder and co-CEO of Remora, and Bav Roy, who is co-founder and COO of Verne.
I think I have more to say about Remora.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was a very cool approach and one that definitely tackles this long tail of current diesel trucks that are still in operation, right? Even if we, you know, change all of our trucks to electric or hydrogen today, there's still this long tail that will be in service for 5-10 years. And Remora is just a very interesting solution for that.
Totally. And I was sort of struck by how it's something that everybody thinks about, you know, at least many people have probably thought about this. I know I have when looking at trucks on the road, I've often wondered, why can't they just capture that, all that crap that's coming out the back, like, you know, capture it and put it somewhere. Like, I think the concept of what they're doing is very like easy to visualize and kind of, so they've got a great hook, they've got a great, right, you know, pitch. And, you know, who wouldn't want to just sort of, you know, what you're telling me is I don't have to buy a whole new expensive truck with all this uncertainty about how it's going to charge or how we're going to get hydrogen to it. I just have to stick a tank on the back. Great. Sign me up.
And there's something that I have a theory that some of the best ideas are ones that sound obvious, right? When in retrospect. So this is one of those that does sound obvious, but of course, you know, if you dive a little bit deeper, there's always other challenges besides that. One question I had for you is, Paul claimed that, you know, this device costs about 30K and each year you would get about, you know, 22K in revenue. And because they split it 50-50, the fleet would actually get about 10 or 11K each year. So the payback time is, you know, under 3 years. You've looked a little bit more on the price of carbon and all of that. How does that, you know, fit in with what you guys have seen in other Climate Now interviews?
We did have a question for him about this, which he answered. Paul said that Remora is planning to sell CO2 at the high end of the price range, $200 to $600 per ton. That's what their estimates are based on. Now, we found that you can purchase pretty high quality CO2 at just over $100 per ton. So their estimates being based on $200 to $600 do seem a little bit on the high side. You also wonder about whether there's enough of a market out there for all the CO2 that they'd be capturing.
I wonder if part of their pricing includes not just the market price that people are willing to pay for this, but also the what companies might be willing to pay for carbon capture, right, and carbon offsets, right? Would Microsoft and Stripe be willing to pay, you know, a substantial portion to say, hey, you're eliminating emissions from these freight vehicles, so maybe combining those two would actually get you to the 200 to 600 that Paul was mentioning.
If you're Verne, aren't you depending on like there being hydrogen infrastructure that exists at scale?
Yeah, that's true.
And that seems like it's a pretty big if, isn't it, that we'll actually develop, you know, green hydrogen infrastructure at the scale needed?
I think it depends on what we mean by scale. Again, because there's so many efforts being put into hydrogen, so much effort being put into hydrogen by the EU, by Japan, by the United States, something will probably work here. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing to keep in mind is that building the infrastructure, especially for transporting hydrogen, is extremely tricky. It's kind of a chicken and egg problem, right? Who has the demand? And then where do you co-locate the pipelines, for example? Yeah. So a lot of folks are focusing on what's called, I think there's a consortium in Europe called HyDeal, where they're basically trying to make sure, hey, is there enough offtake interest for our hydrogen? Are there enough end users in a specific area that we can say, okay, let's start by building pipelines here. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me, from what I've heard, is that most of these hydrogen infrastructure efforts have been focused around ports just because there's so much industrial activity happening there. So on the one hand, I could see, you know, that making it easier for hydrogen to work in a similar environment. But that's different from saying an over the road, you know, highway refueling. That infrastructure will be a little more difficult.
That's it for this episode of the podcast. You can check out our other interviews, watch our videos, and sign up for our newsletter at climatenow.com. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, email us at contact@climatenow.com or tweet us @WeAreClimateNow. We hope you'll join us for our next conversation.